the people who arrive early, which is they get a chance to ask questions. So first, I guess, how were yesterday's tutorials?
I think the tutorials yesterday suffered from being the last one.
Oh, it was the last one yesterday. So.
Yeah, usually we're the first one, but because of scheduling things, I think they were last yesterday. I think after we've done string query and common gravity here, that's like, you know. But I did have three students, and the ones that I interacted with, you know, they were completely so.
Okay. And did the rest of you guys do the problems at home, or? I don't know.
I had to leave early, so I don't think I actually got the tutorial. But if I had, I probably just would have kept doing string theory. Like,
right. I gave you a copy, yeah. So.
Oh, you did? Oh, okay. I should have looked up somewhere. But yeah. No.
Right. Okay.
I just sort of pulled your name. Actually, if you don't mind, I do have a question about the tutorial question from.
Sure.
So, I guess two questions. The first is like a kind of minor one. So, if it scales like S log T. If you have one gate, it means, like, given the definition,
so
you have
S was the number of bits you had, and T was the number of gates.
Right.
Okay.
So you defined big O notation in sort of a weird way. You said that F is big O G if F is less than the CG for all arguments.
Yeah. So that doesn't really matter. Sorry, you're saying that the for all is the weird part.
Right, because then if you have zero, if you have one gate, you have to use zero regular events. Right.
You have to use zero.
Zero is less than this.
Yes. Sorry, but so in big O notation, there's some constant factor that you can stick out far.
Right.
Right. So you can just use that constant to be big enough to take all the small.
You can put that constant big enough unless G is equal to zero. Then that's no constant in the world big enough.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So that's the
So okay. All right. So that's just a definition. Okay. So
yeah.
The other one was. So like, I understand how to do this if you believe that toughly gates, like, you know, you can replace, like, for example, I actually don't know if this is true. Like, if you know that NANDs are universal for classical computation, then it's easy to do because a toughly gate is easy to do. But I don't understand how to do the problem. If you don't know what's, like, does that make sense? Like, I don't know.
Sorry, so to do the problem, and it really doesn't depend on what gate you're using, I don't think. The idea is you just have some, you start with some circuit that does the,
yeah.
Some irreversible circuit that does it. And any irreversible gate, you can convert it to a reversible one just by keeping track of the inputs.
Okay.
Now, specifically, if it's an AND gate, then it becomes a toffle gate.
Yeah.
But other gates.
So you can also always do the same trick to make the bits reusable?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So think about it, right? So if you have any classical gate, which takes, you know, A, B, C, etc. to F of these things, then, well, the gate that instead goes to A, B, C, et cetera, is clearly reversible, right? Because, well, okay. So it has to then take A, B, C, 0, D, so D plus. So this gate is always going to be reversible, right? Whatever F is. Because you've kept the first set of inputs here. Right, and if you just do this gate again, you can calculate f of a through whatever, and then just add it again, so it erases. So
okay, right. Okay.
That's going to be self-inverse always.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
And basically, it computes the right thing.
Okay.
Okay. So, were there other questions about Monday, Tuesday tutorials, whatever? Okay, so so far everything I've done in the class has been with pure states and unitary operations. But there's more to life than pure states. And in fact, that's true in some kind of literal sense, because if you take everything in the world, well, then it's unitary. But if you just look at part of the world, then presumably that part of the world has interacted with the outside world somewhere in the past. So if we just take everything in this room, for instance, well, people are coming in and out of the room. Air molecules are going in and out of the room. Light is coming in and out of the room. Heat is coming in and out of the room, mostly out, I guess. But the point is that when you have part of the universe that's interacting with another part of the universe, that part of the universe is not likely to be in a pure state, right? It's going to have some kind of connection with the rest of the world. And it would be kind of annoying if, in order to do anything quantum mechanical, we had to talk about the pure state of the whole universe. You know, in cosmology, quantum cosmology, maybe they want to do that, though it's a very difficult topic conceptually, and people argue about it endlessly. But for everyday quantum mechanics, that seems extremely awkward. So what we'd like to do is be able to deal with a system that's not in a pure state. So the easiest way to start dealing with this is to think of something which has some probability distribution of pure states. So so pure state, we know that's a state in the Hilbert space. And by contrast, a mixed state is a probability distribution over pure states. Okay, so in order to describe mixed states, we need something called a density matrix. And probably some of you have seen this before. Certainly the people who took Rob Speckin's class have seen it before. I hope the other people have at least seen it before. But just in case some people haven't totally mastered that, I'm going to go over that in the first half of the lecture. And then talk about kind of what you do with measurements and quantum operations when you're in this picture where you're only part of the whole universe. So OK, so, so in particular, suppose we have probability pi of state psi I. So what we do is we then write the density matrix of this mixed state. Frequently, it's denoted by rho or sigma, that kind of Greek letter, whereas somehow pure states are, first of all, pure states have the kets around them. And for whatever reason, we use the Greek letters psi and phi most prominently. For mixed states, we use rho and sigma. Rho is, you know, kind of a density. And this density is supposed to represent some kind of probability density. But I won't try to make that interpretation precise. But that's where the names come from. So anyway, so this is a matrix over this Hilbert space. So let's say this is a d-dimensional Hilbert space. And this density matrix is then going to be a d by d matrix. And we can write it in kind of the operator version of this Sprague-Ket notation this way. Okay. So this you might recognize as a projector on the state psi I. Okay. So if you put an arbitrary state here, it'll take the you'll get here. So this part here would give the component, the amplitude of psi in the direction of psi I. And then you have a psi I piece. So it'll give you something that's proportional to psi I and scaled by how much psi is along psi I, right? So this is a projector on psi I. And it's also the density matrix. You'll notice that if pi is 1 for one value of I and 0 for all the others, then that's exactly what the density matrix is for that state psi I. Right? It's just the projector on psi I. So it's also the density matrix for the pure state. So if you want to convert between density matrix version of pure state and the Hilbert space version of pure state, that's how you do it. Okay, but this density matrix includes the possibility that the probability distribution is not peaked at a single value, and it has multiple pure states making it up. Okay, so here's an example. So suppose we have probability P1 is a half, and psi 1 is 0, and P2 is a quarter, and psi 2 is 1 over root 2, 0 plus 1, and then P3 is a quarter, and psi 3 is 3/5. 0 minus 4/5. So this is a case where you really, it really does pay to be careful about the normalization. Because when we add them up, well, those normalizations are going to add up. I mean, the actual amplitudes, or the squares of the amplitudes in some cases, are going to be adding up between the different cases. And if we were careless about the normalization and did different normalizations for the different states, the adding up would get messed up. Okay. So in this particular case, we can then see that rho is, well, what's the projector here? It's 1/4. Sorry, so it's 1/2. This is probability of 1/2 times the projector on 0. And then this one, we have probability of 1/4 times the projector on psi 2. The projector on psi 2 is going to give us another factor of a half. And we get 0, 0, plus 0, 1, plus 1, 0, plus 1, 1. And then psi 3 gives us another probability of 1/4. And then we have this squared, 9/25, 0, 0. I use minus. Yeah, okay. Minus 12/25, 0, 1. Minus 12/25, 1, 0. Plus 16/25, 1, 1. Okay, everyone with me so far? Just arithmetic. Okay, and then we can add this up. And what we get is that rho, this part is not very interesting. So the thing to notice here is that we have, say, 0, 0 terms appearing in all three of these. I mean, it doesn't have to appear in all of them. But in this particular case, the 0, 0 term appears in all three. And 0, 1 is appearing in two. So we have to add up the different amounts. And so interesting things can happen. And so in this case, we get 1/43/200, 0, 0, plus 1/200, because these two things almost cancel out. 0, 1, plus 1/200, 1, 0, plus 57/200, 1, 1. OK. So silly and not really very representative example, but just to give you an idea of how these calculations go. And then, of course, you can write this in matrix format. That's sometimes easier to work with, frequently easier to work with. And if you do that, here's what you get. Well, the 0, 0 term is 1/43/200. Let's take out the 1/200 in front. And then the off-diagonal terms are 1. And then this term is 57. OK? OK. So that's an example of a density matrix. So now I'd like to talk about the kind of general properties that a density matrix has. Well, Okay, so the first property is that it has trace one. So why is that? Right. So, but it's more than that. It also follows from the fact that the probabilities have to add up to one. Right. So this is just a simple arithmetic. We can take trace of sum of p sum over I. Sorry, p I psi I psi I. Well, what is that? Well, we can bring the trace inside, right, and use the cyclicity of the trace to say that this is sum over I pi psi I psi I. This, by the normalization, is 1. And then the sum of the pi's is also equal to 1. Okay? So this trace 1 condition basically is a probability normalization condition, as well as a state normalization condition. And in general, it's saying that the probability of something happening, or something, you know, being the case with density matrix, is equal to one. Okay, so that's a good property. Next property is that it's Hermitian. Okay, so you can see in the example is actually symmetric because I use just real numbers, but it's easy also to check that it's Hermitian. Right, suppose we have sum over I pi psi I psi I, and we take the adjoint. Well, still have sum over I pi adjoint. Pi is a probability, so it's a real number. So we get pi again. And then psi I is just self-adjoint. So it's we get it back again. Now, I should add that if I'd used complex amplitudes in the states in these examples, then we could have had complex numbers here in the off-diagonal terms, in which case we really do need to take the complex conjugate when we transpose. But the diagonal terms have to be real, right, because it's Hermitian. OK? And then the third property is a little more subtle. So it's positive semi-definite. So what does this mean? This means that if you have any state psi, any state phi, that the expectation value of rho with phi is greater than or equal to 0. OK? It also means that the eigenvalues is equivalent. Eigenvalues of rho are non-negative. Okay. So we know that they're real, right? Because it's Hermitian. And this is saying that they can't be negative. And that's pretty important. So let me first prove this, and then I want to discuss that for a moment. So okay, so this is again not too hard to prove once you think about it. So you have this definition. So we can write this as sum over I pi phi psi I phi, and this of course is just absolute value of phi psi I squared, which is greater than or equal to 0. So this whole thing, therefore, is greater than or equal to 0. OK? So that proves the positive semi-definite. So let's call this A, B, C. And then here's the proof. A, B, C. OK? So This has an important physical interpretation, this property. So the fact that it's Hermitian means we can diagonalize the density matrix, right? So that means we can always write the density matrix in this form as a mixture of orthogonal states. Okay? We can choose some basis. There's some particular basis, the eigenbasis of rho. And rho looks diagonal in that basis. So then we can write rho as a sum of probabilities, which are the eigenvalues, times the different states, right? And the fact that the eigenvalues are non-negative means that the probabilities of each of these states appearing in this decomposition are non-negative. So that's kind of the in some sense, the most natural basis to look at this particular state rho, right? We can write rho then as a mixture of kind of totally separate events, events that are orthogonal. So there's actually some measurement we could make, some physical von Neumann measurement that will distinguish which of these cases occurred. And they each occur with some probability, which are non-negative, so they're really probabilities, and they add up to 1. So something happens all the time. Okay, so that gives you kind of what the physical meaning of these things are about, of these three conditions, is they're telling you that there is a good probability interpretation of the density matrix, at least in some particular basis. Okay? Of course, if you have a different density matrix, the preferred basis that makes it diagonal might be different. And of course, some density matrices will have more than one basis in which they're diagonal. Right? That's fine. You'll have degenerate eigenspaces. Yeah?
When is that expectation value 0?
When is this expectation value 0? So it's so basically, it means in that case, it means that there's that the linear space spanned by phi, right? Which I mean, it's just one vector, but if you ignore normalization, you get a whole line, is orthogonal to the support of rho. So what that means basically is that. So one way of interpreting that is there's some basis. So in that case, there has to be a zero. Phi has to be the zero eigenspace of rho. So there's going to be some basis that includes phi. And you can measure in that basis, and then the probability of getting phi is 0.
So in the Bloch sphere case, that would be the example of pure state?
Yeah, because right. So for a qubit, there's only two dimensions. So if you have one zero eigenvalue, and the other one has to be one, right? Because it's space one, and therefore it's actually a pure state. But if you look at three or higher dimensions, it doesn't have to be. Okay. Any other questions on this? Okay, so one thing that I've kind of alluded to already is that this decomposition of a density matrix into a mixture of pure states is not unique in general. If it's a pure state, it's unique. There's only one pure state. I mean, it's kind of unique. There's some trivial thing where you can say, well, there's probability 1/2 of having this pure state and a probability 1/2 of also having that pure state. That's kind of trivial, not very interesting. But if it's not a pure state, there's more interesting decompositions that all give you the same density matrix. Okay, so that's just implicit, for instance, in the fact that so in this particular example, right, the decomposition I gave you this description. But we know we can diagonalize this density matrix, right, and write it as a sum of the eigenvectors then. With some appropriate probabilities, whatever the eigenvalues are. And that's a different decomposition that gives the same density matrix. Okay, these things are not orthogonal, so this is not the appropriate basis. And there should only be two of them in any case. But there's something that does do that. Okay, and in general, that's always true if you have a mixed state rather than a pure state. There's more than one way of decomposing the density matrix. And it's a very non-trivial fact about quantum mechanics that these different mixtures of pure states are physically indistinguishable. Okay? If you have some kind of outside information that tells you that actually it's this mixture, well, then you can act on that and distinguish that from a different mixture that gives the same density matrix. But if you only have the system described by this density matrix, there's no physical way to tell the difference between a mixture, say, of these three states, and the mixture of the eigenvectors with the appropriate probabilities. Yeah? Well, so for instance, it might be that you prepared this particular mixture and you kept a record. You flipped a coin. If you got a zero, you prepared this state zero. If you got a one, you flipped another coin, and you kept a record of what the coins were. Okay. So that the record of the coins would be this outside information that tells you actually which state you have in this particular case. Okay. And in general, you might have some state that's correlated with another state. And that would provide some extra information to help you interpret. But it's even then, it's kind of subtle. Okay. So maybe I can say something about that when I do the next point. But are there any questions on this so far? Yeah.
Just one comment. I don't know if in general, a pure state can be decomposed in an infinite number of ways.
You mean pure state decomposed as a density matrix?
Right.
Well, yeah, not in any meaningful way.
A mixed state.
Oh, mixed state.
Right.
I guess so. Yeah, pure state can be decomposed only trivially. So yeah. The eigenvalues of the eigenvalues are just a property of the matrix. It's basis independent. It's the decomposition just tells you what density matrix you have, right? But if you have the same density matrix and the eigenvalues are defined, right? That's just a general linear algebra property of the matrix. That doesn't know how you got the matrix. It just says, these are the eigenvalues. And the eigenvectors are similarly well-defined. Of course, if you have a degenerate eigenspace, you know, two eigenvectors with the same eigenvalue, you can take some linear combination of the eigenvectors. And then the eigenvectors are not totally well-defined. But it's a property of the matrix. And the eigenvalues are again, a property of the matrix, and they're a basis-independent property of the matrix. These two properties are also basis-independent properties. So whatever basis you write it in, these things have to all be true. Any more questions? Okay. So that's one way of coming to density matrices. The other way has to do with this idea of a composite system. So density matrix can also represent part of an entangled state. I'm going to talk more about entanglement tomorrow. But in general, suppose you have a state that's an element of a tensor product Hilbert space, HA tensor HB. Okay. And suppose we throw out A. Well, we'd like some way to describe the state of B. And it turns out you can do this using the partial trace. So the partial trace is you write psi in the density matrix form. And so this is going to be row B. So for instance, if these are both two-dimensional Hilbert spaces, you have a 4x4 matrix. Okay, and this kind of breaks down into 4x4. This breaks down into 2x2 submatrices. Right. So, for instance, if you take a basis 0, 1 for A and for B, then when B is 0, the 0, 0 term is going to be this 2x2 matrix that represents the 2x2 things for A, and then when the 0, 1 term for B is going to be this 2x2 matrix, and so on. Okay. And then the partial trace, so you take this, and this is going to become row 0, 0. And this trace, and this is going to become row 0, 1. This is going to be row 1, 0. And this is row 1, 1. And so you get Okay. So I maybe I should have given you some tutorial problems to kind of practice with this partial trace. I didn't, I'm afraid. But you can maybe make up your own examples and fiddle with it. I have some more abstract problems that involve the partial trace a lot. But in any case, the point is that if you start with a pure state on this composite system, then in general, when you throw away system A, you're going to get a mixed state. And similarly, you can throw away system B, and you also get a mixed state. Okay? And this would be the density matrix then of system A. So just taken alone, each of these is a mixed state. And there's no real way to tell the difference between one that was composed this way and one that was created by taking a pure state and throwing away part of it. In fact, there's a more general theorem that if you have a pure state like this that gives you the density matrix, say rho B on system B, then by making an appropriate measurement on A, you can create any of these decompositions for the density matrix rho B. Right? So you make the measurement, you get an outcome. If you look at the outcome, it tells you which of these outcomes I you have. But if you throw away, if you don't look at it, then you have to describe it as a probability distribution, right? Because it's a measurement, it's a quantum measurement, it could be random. And you'll have outcome I with probability pi, and in the case that you have outcome I, you have state psi I. And that's exactly what this mixed state decomposition is supposed to represent. Okay? Well, it wasn't really an argument. It was a statement of a theorem, which is for any decomposition of system B, of the density matrix of system B, into a mixture of pure states like that, there's some measurement you can make on system A that will kind of prepare that mixture. Okay, you'll make the measurement. It'll have outcome I with probability pi. And when you have outcome I, then the residual state of system B will be state psi I. Okay, but then if you kind of ignore the information, you have to describe it as the probability distribution over all these possibilities. Okay. And actually, it turns out you can also go the other way. That's too low. Let's do it up here. So this is a very useful theorem. So if you have rho is some general density matrix on A, then there exists some state psi. Let's see, I guess I should call it HA to be consistent. There exists psi. Acting on, it's in the Hilbert space, HA tensor HB, such that trace over B of psi is equal to rho. Okay? So this is a very useful trick that is often used in quantum information. If you have some density matrix that you have to deal with, but it's easier to deal with pure states. Well, what you can do is you can say, oh, I will take the density matrix and I will purify it. And then I'll work with the pure state. But the cost of doing this is I have to introduce a bigger Hilbert space. Okay. And it's actually very easy to write down this type of purification. So if we have sum over I pi psi I, then we can let this big state be sum over I square root of pi psi I A tensor I B. Okay? So we introduce a Hilbert space that's big enough well, that's whose dimension is equal to the number of states in this decomposition. And then if you think about it, well, we take the trace over B, right? Well, B, the partial trace over B, well, B is kind of not very interesting, right? It just has I in various different blocks. And so when we do that, we're going to get a mixture of these states, the leftover states. Whenever we have state I for B, we have this state. And so therefore, we get a trace over B of psi is just equal to rho. Okay. Right, so there's maybe a few things worth noting about this. So first of all, I guess I should have said this before. I wrote this as a sum. This here is a sum. But there's nothing that says that the number of states psi I has to be finite, even though we're dealing with a finite dimensional Hilbert space. So for instance, you can take, say, some distribution over every state in the Hilbert space, right? Some continuous distribution. And then you should really be writing this as an integral. But mostly it's convenient to write it as a sum. This is enough of a physics class that we can ignore issues about convergence of infinite sums, et cetera, et cetera. This is, again, finite dimensional Hilbert spaces are relatively well behaved, so usually these things work out. Right. So one thing that means here is that if you were to do that in this particular decomposition, B would have to be an infinite dimensional Hilbert space if you wanted to do this particular thing. It's usually easier, well, it depends what you want to do, but it's usually easier just to diagonalize this row and then work with that. And then you can see that the dimension of the Hilbert space of B only has to be the same as the dimension of the Hilbert space of A, right? Because the number of eigenvectors can't be more than the dimension of A. So that tells you kind of the minimum size in general that you need to purify. Obviously, in specific cases, you might need even less. But it might even be pure to start with. Okay? So there are questions on this so far? Okay. So then let's move on. So if we want to look at this picture where the quantum system we're dealing with is just part of a bigger world, well, now at least we know how to talk about states that are somehow correlated with the outside world. Oh, actually, maybe I should just make one additional comment. You can also have a density matrix on this bigger space, HA, HB. Right? So if you have rho AB on HA, HB, then the state of a subsystem is still given by the partial trace. So it's still, say, rho A is trace over B of rho AB. Okay? So you can use then the partial trace to take any big system and take the state, whether it's a pure state or a mixed state, and then shrink it down to the subsystem that you're interested in. Okay, so in order to talk about this picture then, where we want to just focus on one of the subsystems, we also have to know how to deal with measurements and with quantum operations that might interact somehow with the outside world. So so measurements first. So first, if you have some operator, Hermitian operator A, then suppose you have the state psi, then this gives you the expectation value of A with psi. And this kind of corresponds to trace rho A. Okay? Specifically, trace rho A is, you can write this as, say, you have this this decomposition. Sum over pi trace psi I a, which is equal to sum over I pi the expectation value of a with psi I. Right? Again, using the cyclicity of the trace, you can move this projector here. Okay? So what this is saying is you take the expectation value of a for each of the pure states that makes up the density matrix and weight them with the appropriate probabilities that they appear in. And that gives you the expectation value of a for the density matrix. Okay? Basically the same idea is if you have some projective measurement, say pi, 1 minus pi. So pi is the projector on some subspace, so it's kind of the general von Neumann measurement that you might make. And then 1 minus pi is the orthogonal subspace. Then trace rho pi is the probability of the outcome pi. Okay? And that just is basically the same argument. In fact, it follows immediately from this because you can, the probability of pi is psi pi psi. You weight it by the appropriate probabilities pi to get. Okay? Yeah. Yeah. So this is the usual probability. If you make this measurement, but you do it on a mixed state instead, then this is the probability of having an outcome. I mean, this also works if it's a pure state. Then it reduces just exactly to the regular formula. Okay? So now we'd like to even generalize this further. So the more general measurement is called a POVM for positive operator valued measurement. And so POVM consists of some set of matrices EI, where each EI is non-negative, and the sum of the EIs is equal to the identity. So for matrix being greater than or equal to 0 means, I think it does mean that, in fact, the eigenvalues have to be real. So it's Hermitian, and then the eigenvalues are non-negative. And, well, this I think is self-evident. Okay? And when you do this most general POVM, then the probability, so you have an outcome I corresponding to each of these EIs. And the probability of outcome I is, well, guess what? It's just trace rho EI. Okay? Can you see that, everyone? Okay. So you can see immediately, maybe, why we need these two conditions on the EIs. So we need the condition that they're positive so that we know that when we take this trace rho EI, we get something that's non-negative. Right? Because we want it to be a probability, so we don't want it to be a negative number. And we also want the probabilities to add up to 1. And that's why we need this condition. Because then when we take the sum over I of this thing, well, we can bring the sum inside, and then we get just trace rho, which is equal to 1. OK? So if you think about it, physically, these are very sensible conditions. And it turns out that, in fact, these are the only conditions that you need. That if you have some set of operators that satisfy these conditions, then there is a physical operation you can do that will implement this measurement. So specifically, what that means is that for any POVM, there exists some circuit that looks like this. You take your density matrix. You take some ancilla qubits. might be more than one. You do some unitary. And then you do a projective measurement, a regular von Neumann measurement. And in fact, we can just say we're measuring on a computational basis, right? Because we can always do some unitary rotation to bring it into the appropriate computational basis. It might be you don't measure all of the qubits. It's some of them you ignore. You kind of or you can make a complete measurement and then lump together outcomes appropriately. Add up different probabilities of certain results and call that just one result. So there exists some circuit like this that implements EI. Okay. So this theorem is basically an analog of this theorem, right? This one said that density matrices can be purified by looking at larger system, and this one says that POVMs can be, well, not exactly purified, but projectivized, something like that, by looking at a larger system. So it has kind of the same practical and philosophical result, which is to say, well, it's a little awkward maybe to deal with density matrices for this particular case. Let's deal with pure states. We'll look at a larger system, and then we can just use the regular kind of vanilla quantum mechanics, the first thing that you learn with Hilbert spaces and projective measurements. Okay? Yeah?
I guess the unitary operation acts on the density matrix by similarity transformation.
Oh, yeah, so I did not say that. I guess you're right. So that's kind of the next topic, actually, what operations do. When I drew the picture in my notes, I actually put pure state here. But so it would have been less. But yeah, so it's easy to figure out, in fact, what a unitary should do to a density matrix. Because we can just, again, use our decomposition. So suppose we have sum of pi psi I, that's rho. Okay. Now, we know that if we apply u, then psi I could go to u psi I, and the bra psi I could go to psi I u dagger. Right? So under u, this could go to sum pi u psi I psi I u dagger, right? Which is just equal to u rho u dagger. So that's a unitary. OK. But again, there's going to be some kind of generalization of this that applies to more arbitrary things you can do to rho, things that might involve interacting with another system. So let's see if we can deduce the properties that this more general thing should have. So, but before I do that, are there questions on POVMs? So those of you who took the Foundations course, I think, did a fair amount on POVMs. I won't be using them much. For me, for quantum information purposes, this next topic of operations is kind of more important and more interesting. I may not get through all the things today, but then we can finish tomorrow, and you'll have some problems that involve these kind of general quantum operations. So what properties should a general quantum general quantum operation have? You have to preserve the trace. Okay. So there's going to be three properties. That one I actually listed as number two. So why does it have to preserve the trace? Well, we want the total probability. So remember, the trace of rho was important because it told us that the probability of something happening when we made a measurement was equal to 1. And we want that. Sorry, why did I put a question mark? Yes, we must preserve the trace. And the reason is because that after we do some quantum operation, we still want the probability, the total probability of something happening to be equal to 1. Okay, but the first thing is that we want the probability of something happening to be non-negative, right? So that's why I put it first, because if it's not non-negative, we don't even have the interpretation as probability at all. So S must be positive. And actually, we can say more. I mean, it's quantum operation. So we're going to call it S, and it's going to map rho to S of rho. OK, so it must be positive. And more than that, it's going to be a linear map on the space of density matrices. And the space of density matrices, remember, is a slightly different vector space than the Hilbert space that we started with. But the density matrices are, if you have a d-dimensional Hilbert space, density matrices are d by d dimensional matrices. So there's there's d squared parameters. They're not independent parameters because it's trace one Hermitian. But there's d squared parameters that describe that. And S has to be a linear map on this bigger vector space. So it tends not to be convenient to write S as a matrix. Occasionally it is. But if you were, you'd have to think of it as something like a d to the fourth by d to the fourth matrix. OK? So these things seem very sensible, right? So if you take both of these conditions and you apply them, an S that satisfies them, to any density matrix rho, well, you get something that's positive Hermitian and has trace 1, right? So you apply them to any density matrix, you get another density matrix. So that's good. But it turns out that this is not enough. We need another criterion. And so this is called complete positivity. And so what this means is that when S is acting on part of an entangled state, that the overall thing is still positive. So in particular, this, by definition, is saying that I tensor S is a positive map. OK? And this is a pretty non-trivial condition. So I'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow and get into. The reason this comes up is basically because there are entangled states. And I'll be talking about entangled states tomorrow. And do I have time? Do you have time? OK. So let me. A map that satisfies these properties is called, it's completely positive, trace preserving. This condition is kind of assumed. Obviously, if it's completely positive, then it must be positive. So that's why this one is kind of subsumed. Condition one is kind of subsumed by condition three. And sometimes I'll abbreviate that CPTP, completely positive trace preserving. OK, so then we have the following theorem. So the following three are equivalent. So first, S is a CPTP map. Second, for all rho, you can write S of rho equals sum over k, ak rho, ak dagger, with sum over k, ak dagger, ak is equal to the identity. So this is called the Krauss representation. And C, S can be purified. So what does that mean? Well, it means that you have a picture much like this. You have your input state rho. You have some ancillas. You can do some unitary on them that might mix them up. And you get some outputs. And some of these outputs we'll just throw away. That's supposed to be a picture of a trash can. And some of them we'll keep. So one thing you'll notice about this picture is that I drew a different number of lines for the output S of rho than for the input rho. And there's a good reason for that, which is that these completely positive trace-preserving maps can take you from a Hilbert space of one size to a Hilbert space of a different size. It can be big or smaller. Sometimes it's the same. That's fine, too. Okay, so that's one thing that's unlike a unitary. A unitary, you know, is a square matrix, so it could take you from Hilbert space of one size to the Hilbert space of the other size. This doesn't have to be true in general, for general quantum operation. Certainly, this is something that you can physically do, right? However many qubits you're throwing away, that's allowed. You can throw them away. And you can add ancilla qubits in principle. And so therefore, that kind of tells you why the output Hilbert space doesn't have to be the same size as the input Hilbert space. You're just keeping a different amount of stuff. OK? Now, it's not at all obvious that these three things are equivalent. Maybe it's probably the only one that should be pretty straightforward to see is that C implies A. Right? If it can be purified, it can be physically implemented. It has to satisfy these conditions, because these were all kind of motivated by things that we knew had to be true. But it's not obvious that it's the other way. It's not obvious that this is connected with this Krauss representation. Although I guess it's not too hard to check that B implies A. But in fact, all three of these things are equivalent. And B and C are very useful facts when dealing with completely positive trace-preserving maps. Yeah. These AK, so these are called the Krauss operators sometimes. They're just some matrices. Don't have to be square matrices, because this S of rho might be taken to a different size of Hilbert space. But there's some matrices that act on this d-dimensional Hilbert space that rho lives in. And they're kind of arbitrary, except for this condition. Okay, so you have to find some kind of collection of AKs that adds up, and then you can get it to be positive. And the fact that you have AK here and AK dagger here kind of cancels out the fact that these are arbitrary matrices, right? That this tells you that this combination is much better behaved than the individual AK would be. OK. So we're more or less out of time, but maybe a quick question or two. Yeah?
So SR basically their Hermitian? No.
Sorry. So this combination you can see is Hermitian.
Right.
Right? That's an example of why I'm saying that this combination is well behaved because the AK. But the AKs themselves don't have to be.
Right. Yes, yes.
And then S of rho will be. Right. Which it has to be because we want to take a density matrix for density. Okay? Yeah.
Can we choose to compensate as not as AK rho AK dagger, but as AK rho BK dagger?
So there's some kind of general decomposition that looks something like that. I don't remember. I never remember exactly how these deconstructions work. But the problem is, if you do that, it won't automatically be the Hermitian matrix in the output. And so, I mean, for maybe some kind of more general map that's not a completely positive figure image, just some general thing that maps D by D matrices to D by D matrices, you can write it that way. But this particular combination is the one that shows up for CPT commands. I mean, obviously you can call them AK and BK if you want, but then you could let BK void things. Okay, so then tomorrow we'll come back and kind of talk a little bit more about CPT maps and the relationship with entangled states, and mostly talk about entangled states.